Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome again to syndicatednews.net. This evening we welcome Mike Jeffries and Dr. Michael Bone. Gentlemen?
Well, thank you very much. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Family Matters. I'm Mike Jeffries, author of A Family's Heartbreak, A Parent's Introduction to Parental Alienation. I'm sitting in tonight for Jill Ajizi, the author of The Look of Love, and Michelle Lawrence, the author of Good Karma Divorce. Tonight, the United Cerebral Palsy chapter is giving Jill its Board Member of the Year award, while Michelle is meeting with Faye Levin, Ambassador to the Netherlands. So congratulations to Jill, and I'm sure both Jill and Michelle will have plenty to catch you up on when they return. Thanks very much for joining me tonight. I remember when I was a kid and I would stay up to watch Johnny Carson, and then if I saw Joan Rivers or David Brenner hosting the show, I'd get very disappointed and I'd just turn off the TV. So I hope you aren't too disappointed to be spending the next hour with me and you'll stick around. We've got a great show lined up. Our guest is Dr. J. Michael Bone, a noted parental alienation expert and consultant. We're also going to take your calls. I've got to tell you, it is much easier to sit back and answer questions than host a show, so please help me out with plenty of questions for Dr. Bone. By way of an introduction for tonight's guest, I have to tell you a story about Dr. Bone and his article, Parental Alienation Syndrome, How to Detect It and What to Do About It. I was right in the beginning stages of my own parental alienation drama. This was long before I wrote A Family's Heartbreak. And I picked up Richard Gardner's book, The Parental Alienation Syndrome, and I could never read more than 4 or 5 pages at a time. Now, at first I thought my problem was that the book was hitting too close to home, and that was part of it. But then I realized that Gardner's book wasn't an easy read. He wrote his book for the legal and mental health professionals, and I wasn't either one. I later found out that Dr. Gardner didn't even write his book. He actually dictated it to an assistant, which made it even harder for me as the reader. So anyway, I was struggling to make sense of everything, and then one day I came across Dr. Bone's article. Now, I don't know if you remember watching cartoons as a kid, but when Elmer Fudd or Wile E. Coyote finally figured out something, you would literally see the light bulb illuminate over their heads. Well, that was me. I finished Dr. Bone's article, and cue the music, bring up the lights, everything made sense. In fact, his article made so much sense, I asked him if I could include parts of it in A Family Heartbreak so other alienated parents could benefit from his work, and he graciously agreed. So, Dr. Mike Bone, that may not be the most formal introduction you'll ever receive, but welcome to Family Matters.
I appreciate your kind words about that, and I'm especially glad that it was helpful. That article, I still, with some regularity, get contacted by people who have come across it. With the internet these days, something, even though it was written those many years ago, in 1999, it's still very much current out there. So I think it sort of stumbled onto a nerve, and I'm glad to hear that it has been helpful.
So how did you come to write it?
Well, I had been I'd been in practice a good number of years, and I began to be more and more involved in evaluations and things such as that. I developed an interest in that. And then in the process of doing that, I developed an interest in parental alienation. And I think it was an attorney friend of mine who said, you ought to write an article about it. I began to sit down and go, and as I think I had said once before, the article kind of wrote itself. I just sat down and said, now, wait a minute, what do all these cases have in common? What are the things that seem to be always there? Not a long list of things, but there, I identified 4 things, and I identified that if one of them was missing, it probably really wasn't parental alienation. So it was sort of a rather subjective, but I think data-driven kind of conclusion. And then it kind of wrote itself. I mean, I remember putting the 4 criteria on each on 1 4 Post-it notes, and that's kind of how it got done.
So, Dr. Bone, 11 years have passed since the article was published. What's changed on the parental alienation landscape since the article came out?
Well, I think in the United States, understanding how parental alienation works, familiarity with it, et cetera, there's been a lot that's done. I mean, back when that article was written, there was Richard Gardner, there were a few other things written, but not a ton of stuff. Since that time, there's really been quite a lot. There was the last meeting of the AFCC, which is the Association of Family and Court and Conciliation Court, strange name I never understood, was devoted entirely to parental alienation just this year. So there's a lot of work that's been done on it. So I think what's happened when you get that many people looking into this particular problem, it gets dissected. And as a consequence of that, there have been many debates that have developed within that, some of which I think are helpful and on target and some of which I think are not. I mean, the essence of what I was trying to convey, and I still believe it to be accurate, is that the single necessary ingredient that one looks for to find out if a child is alienated in that manner is that you have to have an alienating parent. Without that, you can have all kinds of other bad things, but without that ingredient, it just does not rise to this level. And I think it's good that there's been so much research because a lot of these things have been clarified, but I think there's another side to the coin is it also has entered into a lot of debates that may not be helpful for people actually going through this in the courts, et cetera. So I think it's like most things, it's got an up and a downside.
Now, you mentioned research. Don't we need that academic rigor to include something in the DSM?
Yes, I think the DSM is a very conservative kind of volume, if you will. The development of scientific knowledge and understanding is a slow and conservative process. And I think that's well and good. There are a great many other diagnoses that exist in the DSM-4 that do not have the kind of empirical data that support it that I think we are all looking for with parental alienation. Nonetheless, I think, yeah, it is important that there be a lot of research, but I think it's a little misunderstanding to assume that it has to reach the rigors that of a double-blind, placebo-controlled study like you'd see in a drug study. It's a lot more complicated. It's a family system problem, and that's more difficult to submit and subject to a sort of a medical model, which is what the DSM really is. It's a complicated question, but I think it's necessary. But like a lot of things, it's got an up and a downside.
Now, are there things in the DSM that do not meet that academic rigor of the medical model you described?
Oh, absolutely. I wish, and you're going to ask me for an example probably, and I'd have to pull it out and start thumbing through it. But I can assure you that a lot of the things in there haven't been subjected to this kind of level of rigor that is often purported to be necessary to get in there. For example, when I was in graduate school a long time ago, back when we were in the DSM-2, which was about a half an inch thick, at that particular time there were diagnoses in there that don't exist anymore. There was something called egodystonic homosexuality, where it was considered a psychopathology if someone was homosexual, and they didn't want to be. That was an actual diagnosis. That's since gone away. There's no diagnosis for battered spouse syndrome. In the DSM. And I'm sort of flipping the coin over. There's also, these are common things that are sort of, I think, people understand to be in existence, but that one, for example, is not in the DSM. But it's used routinely in the courts, and there are other examples as well. If back when I was in graduate school, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder was very different than it is now, and I think a lot of it was sort of impressionistic, and that's how all this sort of moves through time and evolves. I think we're in an era right now of sensitivity to what's referred to as pretty hardcore empirical data. But when you talk about a family system, it's very difficult to translate that into that kind of empirical data. And I think that's been one of the challenges.
Okay, you are listening to Family Matters. Our guest is Dr. Mike Bone. Dr. Bone, you mentioned the courts a moment ago, and I know you spend a lot of time in the courts testifying on cases. You spend a lot of time working with attorneys and guardian ad litems. What differences do you see in the courts with respect to parental alienation now compared to when you wrote the article back in 1999?
Well, I think like sort of indicated before, there's a lot more familiarity with it. I think in some cases, as with the familiarity, it sometimes gets used improperly. I mean, I think that's done a great disservice to all of this, because I think sometimes children are estranged and not alienated because of a parent's behavior and their lack of connectedness or neglect or whatever. And children, and in the context of divorce, align more with one parent, but sometimes that is presented as a parental alienation when it really is not. And I think that's done a great disservice. And I think some of the courts have become kind of jaded by that, and when they almost kind of roll their eyes when they hear that term. I mean, these days, I basically recommend that when you present the story of your family's history, which is how I like to think about it, that you almost avoid the term right now because it's become a lightning rod. My advice is to describe the behavior, just because virtually every state in the union has statutory language that says that is very sensitized to which parent will encourage a relationship between the child and the other parent. And that's the opposite of parental alienation, obviously. So by describing it in those terms, I believe that if you get a judge to come up with the light bulb, like Wile E. Coyote, like you were saying before, Mike, this is parental alienation, that's much more effective than telling them it is. If you describe the behavior and sort of lead them to that and allow them to come to their own conclusion, I think you've done a better job at presenting it.
So what is the best way to present a case to the courts? You know, what's the recipe for success that every targeted parent is looking for?
Yeah, good question. I think there is a recipe. I mean, I think part of it is there are several things that happen when a case goes through a court context. First of all, you have a parent who's had a good relationship with children, then there's a separation, and then the children who once had a loving relationship with that parent no longer want to see them and have all kinds of horror stories about it. So the evaluator or the audience, whoever that is, be it a guardian, a psychologist, a judge, whomever the audience is, basically is focused on the present and very easily forgets about the past. And if you forget about what was, you also don't ask yourself the question, what the heck happened here? What caused this? And I think by getting the audience, be it a judge, psychologist, whatever, to say, why did this happen? What is causing that? I think they have to present it with that in mind so that they can't forget how it was. You want to be able to create such an impression of how it had been before that they really have no choice but to grapple with that question of why and what's the cause of it. And once you've done that, I think you've sort of reached the first tier, and then you can move beyond there into some other kinds of things, which has to do with rebranding yourself, because typically the targeted parent is presented in all kinds of negative ways, and the evaluator, the judge, the guardian, whomever, is going to be on the lookout for those characteristics. So I think sensitizing the person to those characteristics and saying whatever you respond, you don't want to do in a way that can be misconstrued as being representative of that. So if somebody is accused of being angry and explosive, and then they, you know, when you're in this kind of situation, you know very well it is an anger-provoking situation because one feels so helpless. But I think you have to modify how you express that in those contexts because it will likely be misunderstood. So developing a sensitivity to that helps to also rebrand yourself, and there's a number of things like that. But, I mean, so the recipe is getting the story right. And by that I mean the story of what's happened in your family. If there's not an emphasis on that, the audience will have little choice but just to look at the present, and the present is kids that don't want to see a parent. So you can't let them do that. You have to be able to let the story unfold, and then as you get to know the audience, be it, again, the evaluator or whatever, whoever the audience is, be able to get them to know who you are and be able to provide examples of things that have happened that allow that audience to look through the situation through your eyes. And I think those are some of the elements of what causes what I've noticed is when judges sort of get it and they realize, wait a minute, this guy didn't do this or this woman didn't do this and they realize what's sort of happening, that light bulb comes on again. You can almost see it. And then the judge starts looking not at the targeted table, you know, than the judge in the courtroom. It always seems to be an elevated bench and two long sort of tables, one with each attorney and the client. You see the judge start to look more suspiciously at the other table because they go, wait a minute, what's going on here? Because everybody has probably been accused of something they didn't do at some point in their life, and that's what we want to do, is to get the audience, be it the judge or whomever, to identify with that and to feel that, and then they begin to respond to it.
Okay, Dr. Bowen, you said about four things in that response I'd like to follow up on. I'd like to remind everybody
I hope you were taking notes, because I wasn't.
Well, let me remind everybody first that you are listening to Family Matters. Our guest is Dr. Michael Bowen. We will be taking your questions in a few minutes, so please get them ready. Dr. Bowen, one of the things you did say in that last response was you want the judges to ask why. You want them to ask what's going on here. Do judges really think like that, or do they expect you to tell them?
Well, they don't really think. That's a very good question. They don't think like that. The judge has think about the judge's experience. There they sit. They're the person in the room, by design, that knows less about the case than anybody else in the room because of the rules of evidence. Okay? You're not allowed to contact the judge ex parte. I mean, that's so by design. The guy up there or the woman up there in the black robe with the big tall table up there, it knows less about this than anybody in the room. And so if they're just presented with the emotionally laden presentation of the child doesn't want to see a parent because they're afraid of them and they're this and they're that, that's going to grab the judge, isn't it? That's going to cause them to go, oh, my gosh, that's terrible, and cause them to want to be protective of the child. So I think the presentation, you have to get in there early enough on and be able to show, well, the child may be saying that now, but what was it like for years before that? Because if you're successful in getting the judge to really understand that and to really experience that, he's got to be able to explain why. I think that part becomes human nature. But do judges normally think like that? No. You have to kind of shove it down their throat a little bit. I hate to say it like that. But you have to kind of make them think that way. You have to make them wonder why. What happened here? And that because it does not, that question gets underemphasized, it gets forgotten, because you're just basically dealing with a static present situation and forgetting how things were. And then if it spends too much time in the present without reference to the past, you got a lot of rehabilitation to do in the case.
So let's sum it up really quickly and then we'll move on. What are the three key points that the litigant and the attorney have to get across to that judge if he or she is a targeted parent?
Okay. I think you have to get them used to, just to pick out three things, I think you have to be able to, it's very important to stress the history of the family. You have to stress it more than the audience wants to hear about it even. And I think there are ways to do that are more palatable by telling stories of incidents that are things that have happened. That's a very important component of it. I think number two, I think the targeted parent has to be sensitized to how they're being portrayed and vilified. And they have to really respond in ways that don't reinforce that, that if anything, cause the audience to begin to empathize with being framed, if you will. Okay, and then I think the third thing to stress is that it's filled with misinformation and distortion, and that the person in the targeted parent's position is always being set up in some particular way. So the visitation doesn't happen. The targeted parent has to respond in some way, and if they don't respond, they're accused of abandoning. If they do respond, they're accused of being unreasonable, insensitive, and all those other kinds of things. So you have to get the court or the audience, whomever it is, to recognize the theme of things are being set up constantly. There are lots of provocations. So I use the term set up a lot because it's very succinct. So I would advise attorneys to use those and use examples so the court gets used to thinking about that. And I think those if you do those three things, you can make some progress. That might solve the problem, at least in the court context.
Okay. Once again, Dr. Bowen, your answer has given me multiple follow up questions. So let me get back to the comment you made: stress it more than the audience wants to hear it.
Yes, okay.
Wouldn't a judge get tired of that repetition, and wouldn't that work against the targeted parent?
That's a let me focus the answer a little bit better. I think in a just a litigation sense, there's not going to be able to tell the story in an unrestricted way in one hearing after another or even a trial setting. I guess what I'm typically, there are other people that are appointed by the court, guardians or evaluators typically, appointed by the court to basically be the eyes and ears of the court, to go in there and sort of lift the hood and say, what the heck's going on here? So that particular audience, and I'm thinking evaluators and guardians, you really want to dwell on that, and I would instruct that parent to really insist on talking about those things. And if the evaluator or guardian sort of directs off of that, I would find a way to get back into it, and I would have the client have about, I'd say, between 4 and 6 specific examples of things that they experienced early on in their relationship with the family's history that are very compelling, that are hard to explain away, that are hard to forget. So I advise people to select your stories. I mean stories, select your incident. I'm not suggesting you distort anything, obviously. But be able to get the truth out, you have to be able to convey it in a way that resonates with the audience. And I think that's, we're storytelling creatures, so that's what we need to do. Sometimes the audience doesn't want to hear the story, but you sort of smile and say, apologize, and you change the subject and tell the story again. But I think you're right, in a courtroom setting, you can't really do that, but if you do it adequately with the guardian or with the evaluator, they'll sort of make your argument for you.
Now, you also talked about the image of the alienated parent. And I've heard you speak in the past, and I've heard you even say that the alienated parent has to be some sort of combination of, I don't know, Mother Teresa and Gandhi.
Yeah.
And cannot display any emotion, cannot display anger, frustration at all. They would then validate what the targeted or what the alienating parent is talking about and saying about them. So tell me a little bit more about the personal presentation that the individual really needs to present.
Okay. I think emotion can be shown, first of all. I think there's certain emotions that are more problematic, anger being the one of the most problematic. I think being upset, that's fine to show that because, my goodness, it is an upsetting thing. And I think that is just the truth. And, again, what we're about is really conveying truthfully what's happened. So I think to hamstring someone and say you can't show emotion, I wouldn't give that necessary advice. I'd say be careful about anger. That's the kind of thing you'd really have to be careful with. And I think you have to prepare someone has to prepare themselves to be able to deal with that and not kind of lose it in that particular capacity. But I think other kinds of emotions like frustration and helplessness and sadness and loss and all those things, I think that's very real, and I would never suggest that someone not convey that. So I think sometimes attorneys advise people just to be sort of like Mr. Spock and emotionless, and I don't see that being very effective at all. I think you do need to express what's going on, but I think you do have to also be careful about anger because that's the one that's been tagged typically. Of all the ones. So you have to just be very careful with that and kind of prepare yourself and almost desensitize yourself before then. And practice being cross-examined. Practice all kinds of things before you go to court.
Now, your answer leads into the setup comment that you made before, because the alienating parent will be doing things to get the negative reaction, the negative emotion from you.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I think that can be shown. Those can be some of the examples given, for example. Like, what is somebody supposed to do when they get to the soccer field or a visitation and they're 5 minutes late and the visitation doesn't happen because of that? And if they go pursue that, then they're portrayed and then the police are called. And, you know, all the things we know can happen so very, very easily. Being able to describe that from an interior experience of the person who's had gone through that. I don't mean just say, well, I went to go for the pickup and the children were already gone and they called the cops and it was a big scene. I mean, I would describe it in some detail, what it felt like, where I was, what I saw, what happened, how I felt. I mean, I think those are things, you know, if you look at people that are very good storytellers, And again, I'm saying story in a truthful sense, obviously, not in any kind of distorted way. But very good storytellers give detail. I mean, the emotion rests in the detail. And by describing specific incidents that convey the setup, that convey that's, you know, in coming up with a half dozen, two or three, four or five, whatever, of that setup, and then describing what it feels like in the story of telling it, I think that's very effective. I've seen that be very, very effective. So you can do that in the presentation as well as in the conveying of the theme of the setup.
Okay, I'll let you take a break for a second, Dr. Bone, and I'll remind everybody that you are listening to Family Matters. I'm Mike Jeffries, the author of A Family's Heartbreak, A Parent's Introduction to Parental Alienation. I'm sitting in tonight for Jill and Michelle, and they will be back for the next show. Our guest is Dr. Mike Bone, a noted parental alienation author and expert. Dr. Bone, let's talk a little bit about case preparation.
Okay.
Who should be taking the lead in terms of preparing for the case?
The client, obviously, the parent has knows the story, has the data, has the experiences. The attorney obviously has a certain kind of purview, and depending on the attorney, and that varies an awful lot, it really, really does. But I think the putting it all together really needs to be kind of a team effort. And I made the decision to sort of change my role a number of years ago to basically address this in that kind of team capacity. Because I think even the best family lawyer can't be expected to understand all the nuances of this. And if you treat one of these cases like it's a non-alienation case, it's probably going to blow up in your face. So I think all the subtleties of the things that are important to be on the lookout for, the tripwires you can easily trip on if you're not aware of them, is part of that. So the case presentation, and the short answer, if I can even come up with one, is that it's a team effort where different assignments are made. And I like to have conference call kinds of meetings with specific assignments, then reconvening and identifying particular problem areas in the case, and then really almost in a spreadsheet kind of thing, and then developing countermeasures for each one of those difficulties and helping the attorney be able to deal with that. I personally think it's very important to be the first to mention the weakest part of the case and not look like you're trying to hide anything. So if there are issues that are, let's say a parent has had an alcohol or drug problem, I would be the first to get that out there so it doesn't appear that there's any kind of deception going on. Because I think all those things can be dealt with, but they have to be presented in a certain kind of way. So I think I'm getting off the track a little bit. But anyway, I think it's a team effort where different parts of the team have different assignments. I always advise parents to keep logs and journals of things. I think that often is done anyway, but I think it can be very, very helpful. But then the goal really is to take all this voluminous information and boil it down to a succinct story, to a theme. It's almost like if you can't describe the story of your case in two or three sentences, you hadn't figured it out yet. So that's what you got to do, is boil it down and be able to very quickly be able to convey it through these stories and through other techniques of fact witnesses followed by expert witnesses.
But as the client, as the litigant, you have to be careful,
yeah,
don't you? Because most professionals, lawyers, psychologists, physicians, you know, even my accountant, they don't like it when the amateur tries to tell them how to do their job.
Yeah, that's true. I think tact is very important, and I think it's too bad we only have one word for lawyers, because I think Eskimos have 27 words for snow, but we only have one word for lawyers, like they're all the same, and they're not. They're more like snowflakes at the risk of a very bad analogy. And I think you have to select a lawyer that is open to input. I mean, some of the best lawyers in the country, and I'm sure some of the most expensive lawyers in the country, are very open to input. I mean, the sign of a good lawyer is knowing what you don't know and being open to input from it. So if you have an attorney who really doesn't want to hear about it, chances are they shouldn't be your lawyer. You need to find one that will be open to this. And that's, I realize that's very difficult advice because it's very, very expensive. But the selection of a lawyer is very important. But I look for those qualities of not feeling threatened, but being open to hear input and to explain why this might not be a good idea. A lot of times I think lawyers sort of go down a decision train. They get a set of facts or set of circumstances, and they sort of go through a decision process in their mind, and then they tell the client what they've come up with, and they don't take them through the process. And I think that excludes the client, and it really breaks down communication. I think there needs to be a willingness to go back and forth, and to, because the client may say, no, it's not this way, it's that way, and that may change the lawyer's outcome. So, I wish there was an easy answer for that one, but I think it's too bad we only have one word for lawyers.
Well, I think the people on the phone would argue that they probably have more than one word for lawyers,
yeah.
But we'll leave that conversation for a different day.
Yeah.
Let's sort of go back to the before and after picture. You know, 11 years ago you wrote the article. Are the courts ruling on alienation more today than they were 11 years ago?
Yes, I think they are. It's being recognized. It's being understood as something that can happen because it's being made more, argued more explicitly in that way. But with that being said, we still have a lot of work to do and what to do about it in terms of the remedies. I think that's the part. There still needs to be a lot of progress made in the courts because oftentimes the solutions that are ended up, even when alienation is found to be a centerpiece of what's happened in a family, oftentimes the remedy is not only inadequate, but also it can actually be counterproductive. And we see that a lot. So the answer is yes, but there still needs to be a lot done. And that's why another thing, you asked me the three things to remember. I think I would add tack a fourth thing on there. You never go to court presenting a problem without also in the next breath presenting a solution in some way. You don't want the court to wonder. You want them to be kind of told. So I think you have to be thinking about a remedy as you're putting all this together and presenting it to the court. I mean, not right off the bat, but once you get in well into the story.
Good addition. You are listening to Family Matters. I'm Mike Jeffries. Our guest is Dr. Michael Bohn. We're going to continue our interview for about another 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'd like to open it up for questions to all of you. Dr. Bohn, you just talked about how the courts are looking at parental alienation cases compared to 11 years ago. How about the mental health profession? What's their opinion of parental alienation compared to when the article came out?
Well, I think there's a lot more clinicians who are familiar with the concept than was the case then. A lot more. Like I said, the AFCC meeting was devoted entirely to it. That wouldn't have happened 10 years ago by a long stride. So it's part of the general diet now, I would say. But that being said, it also there are debates. Mental health people, I think by nature, I don't know, and then when you get some experience under your belt, you sort of have a sense that you know what's going to fix a given situation. So mental health people have a lot of debates with each other about all kinds of things. So in the context of that, there's a lot of debate about what to do about these things, and I think that's where some of the real difficulty has come in. If we could sort of boil it all down, basically the debate these days currently is alienation the kind of thing that is really created by primarily, and I say primarily in a very strong way, the alienating parent? Or is it something that requires the input and contribution of the targeted parent? Now, granted, you can have targeted parents that are really great parents, and you can have targeted parents that are just kind of lousy parents. But being a lousy parent doesn't create alienation. It creates estrangement and alignment with the other parent. So helping people understand the difference is very, very important. But I think the mental health community still is, you know, the general population, if you will, and the mental health professionals are, you know, when you have a kid who is crying, I don't want to see daddy or mommy, it could be either one, and the mental health professional is moved by that and will end up end ultimately very likely supporting that, when in fact what really may need to happen in that case is the child needs to be taken out of the middle and be given access to both parents. And when that happens, when this is what's going on, you see that resistance go away very quickly if there is enough contact. I mean,
Gentlemen, I wanted to offer you a question from the chat room. The question is there a short list of behaviors for the targeted parent to avoid so as not to help further the goals of the alienator?
Yeah, I guess we've been sort of stepping around that. I mean, I think the behaviors to avoid are, I haven't brought this up, but this is a good time to bring it up. I think you have to modify your parenting disciplining style in these kinds of cases. If a child is acting out of alienation and they act in an unreasonable and mean-spirited way, I think it's wise to respond to that differently than you would if this wasn't going on, because responding to that will play in as though alienation wasn't going on, will play into the argument. So I think you have to modify your parenting and learn to put a lot of things on ignore. If you look at the behavioral research on parenting, you really find out that the best way to modify unwanted behavior in children is to put it on ignore. And not lecturing, really, we probably all grew up being lectured and told, you know, how dare you and this sort of thing. That really doesn't have the same effectiveness as some other behavioral techniques. So I think sort of studying up on that and learning to under-respond to those kinds of negative things from a child is helpful. I think also learning how to deal with anger, and maybe if you need to get counseling to help do that so you can sort of disperse some of that, I think that's very, very important. And being able to, and this gets back to what Mike was saying, but Gandhi, like the patience of Job, as far as being able to develop a frustration tolerance. I mean, that doesn't mean you can't express frustration, but you need to do it verbally and not acting it out, because then you're going to stay connected to your audience and they're going to be more likely to identify with you, which is what this is really all about.
Dr. Bone, if I could add to that, I would just remind targeted parents that the parenting rule book has changed. Every old rule they ever operated by has been just jettisoned, and the new rules are in place, but nobody tells you the new rules.
Yeah,
and not only did they not tell you about the new rules, they're going to change them again at some point, and they're not going to tell you about the change or what the third set of rules are. So, you know, I've used the Seinfeld Bizarro World reference to describe this quite often, and I've heard you describe it as a tennis game where you hit a tennis ball over the net and a football comes back at you.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly – yes, it does. I mean, that's if I try to identify specific things, they all hover around that same thing that the rules have changed. And you don't know that. You're just sort of like, what happened? What do I do now? And you're left with that sense of kind of helplessness. But I think there are a few things. Basically, under the heading of learning to under-respond, and that's sort of the Gandhi thing, I guess.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for that question. We are certainly willing and able to answer additional questions if you have them. You are listening to Family Matters. I am Mike Jeffries. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael Bone, and we are talking about parental alienation. We are talking about presentations to the court. We are talking about what the targeted parent has to do, not only to win a case, but to resume or redefine the relationship with the child. And Dr. Bone, let's talk a little bit about the targeted parent, because let's not forget that these are, you know, emotionally devastating experiences for these parents. And they're kind of like fighting a battle on three or four different fronts. And the one that often gets ignored is sort of their own mental and emotional health. And what they need to do in order to stay strong, not only to get through the experience, but to be the same mom or dad that the child remembered before the alienation. So why don't you give us some tips for what these targeted parents should be doing and perhaps what they should be asking their mental health professionals for when they see them?
Very good question and very good point. I certainly agree. The most neglected person in this whole dynamic is the targeted parent as far as taking care of themselves. Absolutely the case. And that is, this has got to be one of the most difficult human experiences to endure. I think there are some things. I think supportive counseling is an important component. It's not the silver bullet. I think there's some other things that can be very, very helpful. There is a subset of literature, if one is a reader and likes to do that sort of thing, called positive psychology, that deals really with, these are some researchers that most psychological research is focused on symptoms and negative things and making, what these folks did was research what causes people to be happy even in unhappy circumstances and what allows them to be resilient. It's very effective stuff, and a lot of the books that are written on this, and there are three or four that are significant, are very, I think, can be applied very much to this. So I always recommend some of this material for parents in this, and sort of suggest that they read it and talk about it and try to implement some of the things. Some of the things that they recommend are practice things you do on a daily basis, like sort of brushing your teeth, but they are steps that you can take on a daily basis to help keep yourself healthy. There's a lot of research now that also shows that meditation can be very, very helpful, and I think it's worth looking into that. See, basically what we're doing in this kind of situation, you're in an extreme, what psychologists call external locus of control. You're not really much of in control of anything. So what you need is to develop some strategies that move that locus of control back internally. Then you can survive this stuff, and you can get through it more happily and more resilience. So I think you can't just think your way into it. You have to practice the steps of it. So that's what I recommend is, and people often develop their own sort of programs, but those components of very like could be meditation, the positive psychology, counseling in a supportive way, but things that you do kind of for yourself to deal with this, it does work. It really does work. It doesn't change anything in terms of the external circumstances, but we know that when one deals internally more at peace with those things, it doesn't have a nearly as an aggravating effect on the external circumstances. So, yeah, that's a very underemphasized area, a very important one.
Yeah, it sounds like you're almost talking about some behavior modification techniques.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You really are. I mean, I read an article recently that identified what kinds of things. There are all kinds of scales. These people that do this research are really kind of the bean counters of happiness. So they test these different strategies. One of them is very simple, too. It's on a daily basis or several times a week, writing down things, three or four or five things that happened that day that you were appreciative of. Now, that may sound sort of Pollyannish, but try that. I challenge you to try that for a week. You will find, and these studies found, that it caused people that were even severely depressed very quickly to respond just by doing that alone. And that was one of the original studies that was done with a lot of this literature. But by just doing those kinds of, and there are other things to be done, but it's a practice. It's like I said, like brushing your teeth or working out or something. But it works. It helps. And it is, you know, you're modifying your behavior, no question about it, and responding in a more positive way. Because if you don't do something, this stuff is so draining, it really can be a drain. Anybody that's gone through this understands that. I'm like, I know you do.
Okay, let's give a moment for someone who's on the line that'd like to join us.
Hello.
Who do we have?
It's Robert Samory, Mike. How are you?
Oh, great. How you doing? Nice.
Terrific. Thanks. Dr. Bone, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I listened very carefully at the beginning and heard you talk about how the courts have changed their understanding of parental alienation and how that's been somewhat beneficial to parents and to children. I'm not sure that the professionals around the court system, the assessors, the social workers, the child protection people, have all moved quite as far. And if you happen to get, I have two questions, by the way. If you happen to get one of those that is still happy to be educated about parental alienation, number one, how can you turn them so that they understand it better, or number two, neutralize them? And my second question before you answer the first so I can get it in is, what sorts of questions can you ask professionals, or more importantly, attorneys, before you hire them to see what their understanding of parental alienation is?
Good questions, Robert. Thank you very much. Dr.
Yes,
Bone?
Thank you. Well, the answer to the first question is we let's say you have an evaluator that you don't know where they stand on it. Rather than ask them the direct questions, I would, if they've already been appointed to the court, you want to simply meet with them and start telling your story again, initially with emphasis on the pre-separation story of your family, and the rest, with focus on the relationship between yourself and the children that are now alienated. And if you spend enough time with that and you really let that resonate within them, they're going to have to somehow explain what happened. And I think that's the most effective way to get them to have the light bulb potentially go on. You know, there's an old, I remember years and years ago, I read a, this is about therapy, it has nothing to do with this, but I think it's a very telling analogy. If I read a study that evaluated people that were in therapy for a long period of time, and it was a linguistic study, evaluating the language used by therapists and by their patients with whom they were in treatment, that sort of thing. And what they found, perhaps not surprisingly, is that the longer somebody was in therapy, the more they talked about themselves like their therapist did. In other words, it conveyed that there is a transfer of information from the therapist to the patient. But it's subtle. It's experienced as insight if the therapy is actually good. It's experienced as insight by the patient. But really what's going on, there's a transfer of information. So I think that analogously you have to treat an evaluator almost like it's a therapy thing, like you're the therapist. And you have to bring them into what's happened in your life so the light bulb goes on for them. So they begin to go, wait a minute, what happened? The kids don't act this way when they have been abused by a parent. They don't act this way at all. And I think there are ways to be able to describe that to the evaluator early on without even using the words parental alienation. So that would be my answer to question number one. Number two, I would start out with a lawyer I would kick the tires and say, what do you know about this parental alienation stuff? How is that handled here? Have you had cases like that? Tell me about them. How do the judges rule on that? Is it accepted by the guardians? And how is that? I would just talk about it in general and just find out how current they are on it. If they're familiar with it, they'll talk about it quite a while. If they're not, they go, oh, yeah, that's a terrible thing. And, oh, it's sort of like it's pretty normal. All cases have a little bit of that. Whenever you hear attorneys say all cases have a little bit of that, they're probably not the right one for you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you very much, Dr. Bone. We are happy to take your questions either online or over the phone. You are listening to Family Matters. I am Mike Jeffries. Dr. Bone, let's talk about some real-life examples for a second. And I know for confidentiality reasons, you can't talk about the specifics of the cases you're involved in.
Right.
But maybe you can talk about them generally. And give us some real-life examples of what's going right and what's going wrong as these parents try to regain a relationship with their children.
I mean, outside of the court, I mean, regardless of what the court's done, that sort of thing?
Sure.
I think, yeah, okay, that's a very good question. What I see, even when children are in, and I'm talking about teenagers now, in the example I'm thinking of right now, and a few others that I'm also thinking of, when a parent who's a targeted parent really learns to not respond to the provocations by the children when they are with them. Now, that implies that that is premised on the idea that there is contact, of course. But when the parent learns to under-respond to the provocation, it's almost like if you could take a transcript of all the things that a child said and all the nasty stuff and the mean-spirited stuff, the stuff of the alienation, is if you take a bottle of white out and just erase it and don't respond to that part and just respond to what's left, that will bear much more fruit than not. It's difficult to do that, but I think that's where the program that you can sort of work on yourself can be very, very helpful in that regard. So being able to not respond in a way that the child has been told that you are, because that's what happens. I mean, these children are told all kinds of things that aren't true and that you're going to react this way, and then if you get upset because they say something horribly cruel and you react that way, it tends to confirm it, as opposed to if you just put it on ignore. This may sound unrealistic, but it does work. I've seen it, but it's hard to do. It takes a while. It takes a long time. And typically this is a strategy that's more effective with teenagers than with younger children, but it also works with younger children. So now, that would be one thing that where it works. I think when a parent is kind of rigid and says, well, I'm not going to put up with this. I'm not going to deal with this kind of behavior. I would have gotten my mouth washed out with soap if I had done, or I would have not – I would not survive the next day if I had acted like, and then respond in a kind of a disciplinary way that is might be reasonable in another context, but in this context would just be poison. I remember Richard Gardner told me that he was working with some particular case, and he said he had this father who was in the midst of all this, and the children were preteens. But when he would see them and they'd act badly, he would spank them. And Gardner said, what are you, nuts? What are you doing? All you're going to do is make things worse. And this is a family that spanked, and depending how you feel about that. But that was the status quo for this particular family. But in that kind of situation, it was like, don't do that. And you need to develop other strategies, because that will definitely make it worse. That's part of the setup. That's part of the provocations.
And like we talked about earlier, the rules of the game have changed. The old parenting rules are history. There are new rules in place, and sadly, you are guessing at what they are most of the time.
Yeah, I agree with that, Mike. But I think also there are some principles that can probably work through even with the changing rules. I've created about three. This is at the risk of a commercial plug here. I don't mean it to be, but just it's something I've been working on recently. I've got three fairly brief little audio presentations about parenting with this kind of negative behavior and the kind of things that work and the kind of, and there are not that many, and all of the things that don't work. But I think there are things that you can carry with you even as the rules change that don't cause one to fall for the provocations. So I think, I agree with you, but I think there are some probably basic things about under-responding, about not being provoked, about having the patience of Job and things like that, but with an understanding that this behavior really, the child is being held hostage and put in the middle, and it's hard to remember that sometimes when you're being screamed at.
Very true, very true.
Yeah.
Once again, you are listening to Family Matters. I am Mike Jeffries. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael Bone, the noted parental alienation expert. Dr. Bone, we started talking this evening by referencing your article from 11 years ago. We're coming down to the last few minutes of the program, so maybe let's end there as well.
Okay.
What have you learned about parental alienation in the 11 years since you first wrote that article?
Well, you didn't tell me you were going to ask me that. Okay, you threw one in on me, huh? Okay, fair question. I think that the basic – what I'm struck with is I think the basic premises that – in my opinion, from dealing with many, many, many of these cases and what I've seen over and over again, the necessary ingredient for alienation versus estrangement is an alienating parent. That simply is the case. And I think that has – I've looked at all different ways to look at that over the years, and that just still seems to be the case. I mean, I've considered a lot of the other opinions about that, and it just doesn't seem to ring true, and it doesn't seem to really work on the ground. So I think that part remains the same. I think in terms of how to intervene, I think we have learned a lot. I've certainly learned a lot about how to work with children and when they are in these kinds of situations. Sometimes there is a – I think in the past, I would sometimes feel a need for the children to be able to know what the truth was. That doesn't work. That will simply cause them to push back and become counter-alienated, actually. So I think there are things about how you approach this that I think is the product of just dealing with a bunch of these kinds of cases, that kind of those approaches have changed. I think we still have a tremendous amount to do in that area. You know, the analogy I like to use, and maybe I've beaten this horse too much, I don't know, but I think of alienation as a child's irrational response, negative response to a parent. Just think of that, just an irrational emotional response. And the first analogy that comes to mind is that's kind of what a phobia is. Somebody that's phobic of bridges has an irrational fear of bridges. Now, we know from treating what psychologists call simple phobias, like a bridge, that we know that if I try to get somebody in therapy who's phobic of bridges and I talk to them about their fears and how terrible it is and how their fears of the bridges and perhaps – and I validate it. And I go, oh, that's how terrible that is and so forth. I'm actually reinforcing the irrational fear of the bridge. We know from lots of research done on this that the best way to get the person over that is to guess what? Get them to go over the bridge with their fear, to address the irrational nature of it. So I think the remedy to this, analogously, is even when children are resistant, to be able to move forward, get them reconnected with that parent. And I think we have lots of research, well, there's more growing research, that shows that when children are taken out of the middle, they really kind of relax and they become who they really are again. So I think that's the principle that we need to work more in making clear to the courts and all the other people that have an interest in this. I don't remember what your question was now.
That's okay. I've got follow-ups anyway. we will take questions if anyone wants to ask something either online or over the phone. You talked about the bridge concept and the behavior modification. But talk a little bit more about that, because you don't modify the behavior by taking the person across the bridge on the first day. You know, you got to work up to it. You maybe bring them within the same area of the bridge. Then maybe you ask them to put one foot on it for a couple seconds. Then maybe a step. So, you know, what is a reasonable timeline for the type of modification you're talking about?
It should be measured in weeks, not months. Frankly, the first step in treating someone like that is to get them to recognize that they have an irrational fear, to recognize that it's in their head, so to speak, that it's not in the bridge. The bridge is statistically not going to probably cave in, that it's an irrational, unreasonable fear. So that's the first step. So how do you do that with alienated kids? You can't do it too terribly directly. You have to do it more indirectly. The program Family Bridges, the one developed by Randy Rand and Richard Warshak, it's an ingenious kind of thing where they basically show children through various different means, exercises, videos, experimental kinds of things that are kind of fun to participate in, how easily we as humans get things wrong, how we misperceive things, how we think we're right. I mean, the story I like to tell is years and years ago, I was driving home from work and right on a Friday evening, and there was a drunk guy in a truck coming the opposite direction. He swerved and hit a car in front of me, and I almost ran into it myself, but the person whom he hit, there were two elderly women, one was killed, and it was like right in front of me. So this truck was sitting exactly right in front of me, 5 feet from my car. And because of all that, I became a witness that I had to fill out a statement, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's a pretty freaky thing to have something like that happen right in front of you. And because of that, and I understand how memory works and those kinds of things, when I filled out my statement and swore to it being the truth, I had the truck facing in the wrong direction and the wrong color. Because the emotional nature of it caused me to misrecord that and fill in the blanks, and that's what we do. We don't remember things because we're traumatized, and we fill in the blanks later. It's called source misattribution. So, I mean, by stories like that, getting kids to realize, whoops, you thought it was this, it was really that. Whoops. And then other examples, telling personal stories about things like that, that sets the stage for them to begin to realize that, wait a minute, maybe this is not a reasonable kind of fear. And I think that's what Rorschach's program and Rand has done a very good job at.
Okay, gentlemen. We have had a fantastic evening, and do you know we're down to the last 30 seconds? So we ask that you go ahead and say good night, and I can't thank you enough. You have been terrific.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ruthie, and thank you, Dr. Michael Bone. One more time, let's say that I am Mike Jeffries, the author of A Family's Heartbreak. Jill and Michelle will be in next time, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. The look of love, it's saying so much more than just words could ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited, waited just to love you. Now that I've found you, you've got the look of love. It's on your face, the look, the time can't erase. Be mine tonight. Let this be just the start of so many nights like this. Let's take our lover's vow and then seal it with a kiss. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited, waited just to love you. Now that I have found you, don't ever go. Don't ever go. Thank you.